fall. Maybe it's not mine. Our chance with crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle of it.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth for the beginning of the second hour. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Let me tell you about our final guest for this evening. The name is John Lott. He's the author of More Guns, Less Crime. He has a doctorate in economics from UCLA in 1984. He's virtually written over 90 articles in academic journals. His interests are economics, law, crime, public choice, education, writing. He goes on and on. He's very sharp. He was on Coast to Coast last night. I listened to one of the finest interviews I think George Norrie's ever conducted. And I want to welcome to our program John Lott.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, I'm sorry there was a mix-up there on the scheduling a little bit, but I think we put out there Central Standard Time. But anyway, no problem. We're very, very honored to have you, John Lott, and we certainly do appreciate your work. And let's start out. How did you get involved in writing this book, More Guns and Less Crime? What was your motivational factors in getting that going several years ago?
Right. Well, I was teaching at the Wharton School of Business, and I was teaching a class on crime. Yeah, before that, I'd been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and I'd taught a lot of classes on crime and written economics papers on crime and law enforcement. And some students asked me if I could give a brief discussion on gun control, and I figured, well, you know, why not? But to do that, it kind of forced me to go through the literature. I hadn't really been very interested in the literature on guns up to that point. And I'd seen some of it, but I hadn't systematically gone through it. I guess I'd always assumed that there are better papers someplace else. And I was just pretty shocked by how poorly done the existing research was. Large studies would look at 31 counties from the United States. I could never figure out how you'd pick out 31 counties out of 3,140 counties to look at. And when you're an academic, one of the reasons why you do research is you think you can do a better job than other people have, or you have a new idea, and it's usually the latter. But I thought, you know, it'd be worthwhile to do the study the right way, and it took me a couple of years to put it together and started off as an academic paper and got some attention, and then University of Chicago Press asked me to turn it into a book.
Right. Did your idea change?
That came out in 98. That came out in 1998. But the third edition just came out in 2010.
All right. Well, then it has sticking power, doesn't it? Staying power, does it? Does it not?
Yeah, no, I'd say so. The third edition has about 300 more pages of material than the first edition had.
What would you say has been this additional research that you've added to the third edition? But also, then you've made it very, very current, have you not?
Well, there are a lot of things that have changed over the last decade. The third edition came out in 2010. The second edition came out in 2000. Over the last decade, we had the sunsetting of the assault weapons ban. You've had a lot of states have stand-your-ground type laws. My research was the first one to look at that. You've had more states adopt right to carry. We now have 41 states that are right to carry. Really a major change in the last few decades. You go back to 1986, You had 21 states that completely banned concealed carry. You had another 20 states, which made it difficult. You basically had to go and get the approval of some public official, like a judge or a sheriff, before they would let you carry a concealed handgun. With the appeals court decision last week and for Illinois, Illinois had been the last state that had banned people being able to carry concealed handguns completely. And the judges said that that was unconstitutional. And so now there'll be 42 states that are right to carry and only eight which require that you have to go and get some type of public official's approval. But all the states have some process for people to be able to carry concealed handguns. So that's a pretty major change since 1986.
Well, I'll say that your book probably had a lot to do with that. Are there legislators that are talking to you and interviewing you all the time about your different proposals and assertions in this book?
Well, I've talked to a number of people. I've testified before state legislators many times. You know, who knows how much impact research has versus other experiences. I mean, surely the fact that permit holders have tended to be extremely law-abiding matters. The most recent data that I've seen for Florida, for example, which is fairly typical, but it has unusually good data on its website, between October 1st, 1987, and the end of June this year, Florida had issued permits to over 2.3 million people. The average person had had their permits for about 13 years. And yet with millions of people having permits and all those years that they had them for, only 168 had had their permits revoked for any type of firearms-related violation. The vast majority of those were for two simple reasons. Either one, they accidentally carried their permit concealed handgun into a gun-free zone, like an airport, for example, or a school, or they forgot to have the permit with them when they were carrying. Both of those are considered firearms-related violations, and they lose their permits for that. So even, but 168 out of 2.3 million is only, is 7/1000ths of 1 percentage point. It's 0.007%. It's pretty tiny, and, you know, it's the type of thing you find when you look at other states. Permit holders are extremely law-abiding. They rarely get into any type of trouble, and my guess is it's been very important in having all these different states adopt these rules.
Well, I tell you what, is brandishing a gun a crime in most states?
Well, it depends why you're brandishing it. If you're brandishing it because you're being threatened, then, you know, it's not a problem. If you're brandishing it to threaten somebody, then it's a real problem, then it's a crime.
Well,
it's a crime anyways.
Yeah, there's so many statistics like that where things are avoided, crimes are avoided by someone brandishing a gun and keeping someone from imposing a crime on them or attacking them. I mean, there's so many different hidden statistics like that, are there not?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the way most crimes are stopped, is not firing the gun. People who use guns defensively very rarely fire the gun. Simply having the gun, simply letting the criminal know that you have a gun, is enough to get criminals to run away and break off the attack. You know, they know the cost of getting involved against somebody who might be able to defend themselves. And, I think you're exactly right. Those are important statistics. And, you know, the news media doesn't cover those types of cases, even though you may have 95% or so of the time simply brandishing guns sufficient to cause a criminal break off an attack. You know, that's not really newsworthy. Defensive gun uses that get covered are going to be cases when the criminal's been killed.
Right. We're going to take a break real quick here. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Thank you for being with us this evening, John Lund. Welcome back to the Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, Charlotte. Little Phil is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lund.
Thank you.
Okay, on this gun-free zones, can that be rather problematic? And what is the trend in those areas, in universities and, say, public school systems? What kind of information and have you developed in that area?
Right. Well, I'm sure everybody kind of understands the motivations behind having these gun-free zones. The idea is if you simply ban guns from an area, you'll make them safer. The problem is, this is true for gun control laws generally, is who obeys the laws? And if it turns out that the law-abiding good citizens who don't have guns there, but the criminals do, then you can unintentionally make things a lot worse. You know, I suppose the simplest way to think about this is that if somebody was seriously threatening you or your family, was stalking you, would you feel safer putting a sign in front of your home that said this home was a gun-free zone? My guess is nobody would do that. And the reason is pretty obvious. You don't want to go and tell a criminal who's stalking you, you know, if he's really stalking you, that there's no weapon inside the home in order to try to protect yourself. What that does is that actually serves as an invitation for him to come and go and get you. And, you know, we see this all the time. All these multiple victim public shootings are occurring where guns are banned. You know, you look at something like the Aurora movie theater shooting this summer. There are 7 movie theaters within a 20-minute drive of the killer's apartment that were showing the new Batman movie that was being released. The killer didn't go to the movie theater that was closest to his home. He didn't go to the largest one. He went to the only movie theater that banned permit holders from being able to carry their handguns into the movie theater. And you see that, you know, the Sikh temple, the Portland Mall shooting that just occurred earlier this week, the shooting on Friday. In fact, if you look at all the multiple victim public shootings since at least 1950, with only one exception, all those multiple victim public shootings where more than 3 people have been killed have all taken place where guns are banned. You know, you name a shooting, and it's going to take place where guns are banned. And so, you know, I understand the motivation to try to make things safe, but what's happened is that rather than making those safe areas, they serve as magnets for the criminals to go. That's where they want to do their attack. They want to do their attack where they know that their victims aren't going to be able to defend themselves. And, you know, you look at things, even the Columbine shooting back in 98, you had a situation where the Dylan Klebold in particular, but both of the killers there, were strongly opposed to the concealed carry law. It's my understanding that at least Klebold was writing to state legislators asking that they not vote in favor of the law. And what few people seem to realize is that the final vote for the state legislature to pass the concealed handgun law there was scheduled the very day that the Columbine attack occurred. And what apparently had upset Klebold the most was that that concealed carry law would have allowed people to carry permanent concealed handguns on high school property, on school property. So, you know, you just see this time after time. There are only usually very small areas in states which are banned, which are posted for you not being able to carry concealed handguns. And yet those are the places where all these attacks are occurring. You know, if it was random, then only a very small percentage of the attacks would be taking place in these gun-free zones. But that's not the case.
You know, you said something earlier in one of your writings there that you've suffered over the years in taking this ban and writing this book, have you not?
Oh, I don't know if I want to get into that too much. I mean, there are a few things, but, you know, things like Richard Daley, the mayor of Chicago, when I was at the University of Chicago, he basically threatened the University of Chicago with losing, you know, operations that they were doing with the city of Chicago if they didn't get rid of me and things like that.
Right, Well, I didn't want to delve into it too deeply, but, I mean, it seems like that this liberal mindset out here can't let go of the fact that they demonize the gun itself, right, and ignore the individual that has to pull the trigger, right?
Right. Well, I'm not sure I would argue that way from your perspective. The way I would say it is, look, guns do make it easier for bad things to happen. I don't think one should argue against that. But I think the point to make is that guns also make it easier to defend yourself and prevent bad things from happening. And the question is, what's the net effect that's there? Look, my research finds that the police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. I'm convinced about that. But one thing the police will tell you when you talk to them is that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And, you know, they'll tell you themselves that they strongly support letting citizens be able to go and defend themselves when the police aren't able to be there in order to protect them. You look at surveys of by the National Association of Chiefs of Police. You have about 78% of those police chiefs around the country support people being able to carry concealed handguns. In fact, they support a national concealed carry, just like a driver's license. If you get a concealed license in Oklahoma or someplace else, just like you get a driver's license there, you should be able to go and drive your car any place and should be able to take your permit concealed handgun when you travel, too. And if you look at street officers are even more supportive. Depending upon the poll, you're often talking about something about 85 to 90% of street officers support citizens being able to carry permit concealed handguns for protection. They see firsthand the benefits in their own life from having a gun for protection, and they understand why they are important, that they just can't be there all the time to protect people. And so they understand firsthand the benefits from people being able to carry concealed handguns.
Right. Have there been instances where, at schools and so forth over the years, where individuals had guns in their cars or trucks and went out and stopped even a further carnage? Have there been cases like that?
Oh, there have been many cases like that. You have public schools like Pearl, Mississippi or Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. You have universities like the Appalachian Law School in Virginia, in which an attack was stopped. You have churches like the New Life Church in Colorado a few years ago, where you had one of these mega churches. It was 7,000 people. One of the parishioners there was a former Chicago police officer, but she had stopped doing that years earlier. Her former husband was stalking her, so she had gotten a concealed handgun permit, and she had asked the minister whether it was all right for her to carry a concealed handgun there at church, because she was worried that if she didn't have it with her while she was at church, then she would be vulnerable either on her way to church or on her way from church. And the minister said, sure, no problem. And what happened was a killer there killed a couple people in the parking lot, went into the church, and at that point this permit holder wounded him, and he committed suicide. But he had like 1,000 rounds of ammunition, and there were 7,000 people in the church.
Right. We've got to take another break, and we'll be right back. Thank you, John Lott. Appreciate you being with us. I'm George Butler, Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lott.
Well, thank you.
Well, I tell you what, John, you really, you know, done your research on this, and you really have a lot of details and facts at your fingertips. What is the concept and ideas right now on common law right to carry as far as in your vehicle or on your person? Is there any common law rights throughout the country in the 50 states?
Well, it's pretty much determined by statute. And it varies a lot from state to state. There's some states that you don't need to have a permit to carry in your car. There are other states that do require that you have a permit. So it's just, you know, it varies a lot, and just incumbent upon you to kind of know what the rules are.
Right. As far as your studies go, from when you first started writing your book, was it 1998? Is that when it first published, the first edition?
That's correct.
Okay, now you're in your third edition. In the real inner cities, have you seen a major change there in crime because of the right to carry or whatever? Have you do you have statistics that would indicate anything like that?
Right. Well, in fact, there are two groups of people who benefit the most from being able to carry. One group are people who are relatively weak physically, women, the elderly. But the second group of people refers to the area that you're talking about, and that is people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime benefit the most from having the option to be able to protect themselves. And that's a very well-defined group, unfortunately, in our society. It's poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. I mean, again, it'd be great if the police were there to protect people all the time. And the police are extremely important, but they arrive on the crime scenes after the crime's been committed, usually, and that means that people who are the victims of crime, most likely to be victims of crime, benefit the most from having guns for protection.
Right. Now, how does this drug culture factor into this? Has this been a really synergistically negative on getting the crime just embroiled and increased in these different areas?
Yeah, well, if you look across the United States, about 80% of the counties in any given year have zero murders. You have over 70% of the murders in the United States occur in about 3% of the counties. And if you ever live in a major city, you know, whether it be New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or Washington, D.C., often the major newspapers in those areas will go and once a year or so have a map of how murders are distributed in those cities. And they're not all over the place. Even in those places, they're very heavily concentrated in very small areas within those cities. So not only do you have over 70% of murders in just 3% of the counties, but even within that 3%, they're in very tiny areas within that 3%. And a lot of that is drug gang, either directly or indirectly related. And, and that creates lots of problems.
So what you're saying is on the periphery of some of these drug areas, it makes sense to have a gun handy because you might get caught up inadvertently from some of this drug war going on. I mean, is that good thinking there?
Right. Well, I mean, it's not just the people who are directly in the drug gangs, the fights there, but you have people who are kind of secondary involved who are not exactly the best people to hang around with, and they threaten other people. But that's exactly right. Those are the areas where people benefit the most from having the option to be able to protect themselves. You have a lot of people whose lives are messed up in different ways from the drugs. They're probably not the best people to be around. And you have crime for many different reasons in those areas, and those are the people who benefit from protection. One of the things to point out, though, is just as it's very hard to stop illegal drugs from coming into the country, I mean, these drug gangs, it's very hard to stop them getting their drugs. It's also very hard to stop them from getting the weapons that they use to protect their drugs. I mean, here they have something extremely valuable. It's not like if one gang comes over and steals another gang's drugs, the second gang goes to the police and say, could you help us get our drugs back? They have to go and have their weapons there in order to stop the drugs from being stolen to begin with or to take them back. They set up their own little armies. And just as they can smuggle in the drugs, they can smuggle in the weapons that they use to protect those drugs. And so you see countries like that have had gun bans, like Ireland or Jamaica or the UK, they still have plenty of guns in those countries. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting is that whenever you see gun bans go into place, even in island nations, which you would think would be kind of the ideal experiment for a gun ban, you see increases in murder rates after the ban's been put in place. I can't find a place around the world where we've had gun bans that you don't see an increase in murder and violent crime after the ban's in place there. And the reason is simple. It basically follows along what we were saying at the beginning of the program, and that is the people who obey these laws are the good law-abiding citizens, not the criminals. And to the extent that you disarm the law-abiding citizens relative to the criminals, you make it easier for those criminals to engage in their crime.
Well, I tell you what, I just wish more more Americans would start catching on to this, because there's a population out there that thinks diametrically opposed to this, is there not?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the media has a big impact on this. People constantly hear about bad things that happen with guns. They rarely, if ever, hear about any of the benefits from guns. And it has a big impact on people's perceptions. I mean, when was the last time you watched ABC, NBC, CBS, or CNN, or MSNBC and heard a story about somebody using guns to protect themselves, protect somebody else? And my guess is you've never heard a story on those networks about that. And if you constantly hear about bad things that happen and never hear about any benefits, it has a real impact on people's perceptions about the costs and benefits of guns. You know, the government does a survey every year to try to figure out how many crimes are committed with guns, because they know not all crimes are reported. And you'll have something like about, 150,000 gun crimes are reported to police each year, maybe 175,000. And there's about 400,000, some years maybe, well, it's about 400,000 right now, gun crimes that are indicated in terms of the surveys. Well, if you do a similar survey in terms of defensive gun use, you find that people use guns defensively to stop crime about 2 million times a year. That means people use guns defensively to stop crime about 4 to 5 times more frequently each year than guns are used in the commission of crime. But few would know that, because they get most of their information from the media and they only hear about the bad things and never about the benefits. But I think the media has a big impact in another way, and that is we have these attacks, whether it be at the Aurora movie theaters or the mall shooting or the school shootings this week. How many people know that those attacks, all as well as all the other ones that they could think of, are occurring where guns are banned? And you know, they just refuse. That's probably the simplest fact that they could go and check, but they never bring it up. Instead, you have them go through things that they're often wrong about. So you have half the people or more believe that the guy who did the Aurora movie theater shooting was wearing body armor. You know, I don't know how many times you hear about the claim that he had a bulletproof vest. Well, he didn't have. First of all, there's no such thing as a bulletproof vest. It's bullet-resistant vest. But even in that case, he didn't have a bulletproof vest. He had something called an assault vest. And what an assault vest is, essentially made out of nylon, which is hardly bullet resistant, and it has extra pockets so somebody can hold extra magazines to reload his gun. And yet somehow the media has kind of spun that into a bulletproof vest.
Right, okay. John, we've got to take another break. We'll come back to our title segment. Get your thoughts together to give the best advice to the public that you can. We certainly appreciate your being with us this evening. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lott.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, this last segment, I'm going to give you the floor, and you can tell us what I missed in asking you, or what other very important points that you feel like that we should bring out during this last segment. So you got the floor.
Well, if you want to talk about these mass public shootings, one of the things that's clear when you read the diaries or other documents that these people leave behind or listen to the videotapes is that they're intent on committing suicide. And indeed, 75% of the people who engage in these types of attacks die at the scene. And the other 25%, it's pretty clear that they intended on committing suicide but just couldn't bring themselves to actually kill themselves at the end there. But what they want to do is they want to kill themselves in a way that's going to go and get attention for them. And it's really chilling to go and read what they've written, because they're often very explicit that they realize that they can go and get more. The more people they kill, the more publicity that they can get. And so, you know, the issue basically is, how do you take away that gain that they view in their warped mind that they get from doing these crimes? And there are a couple things to point out. One is they thrive on the attention. They are doing this. They're trying to kill as many people because they believe that's the way they can get more attention. So to the extent to which, and I'm not saying this is something that's going to change, but to the extent to which the media, you know, gives attention to these guys, they are encouraged to do this. If the media tomorrow stopped publishing their names, that would probably reduce to a good extent the rate at which these attacks occur. The second thing is that one of the reasons why they pick these gun-free zones to engage in these crimes is because they know a pretty simple truth, and that is things that I found in my research, and that is the longer the amount of time it takes for somebody with a gun to arrive on the scene to stop them, the more carnage that you're going to have. And the faster you can get a gun there, the sooner you can stop it. And police, you know, 8-minute response time is phenomenal. 5 minutes is unheard of. And yet in 5 minutes or 8 minutes or 10, you can have a world of hurt that's going to be caused in that situation. And so one thing that's proven to be very successful in the cases that we've talked about is to let people have the option to be able to go and defend themselves. You constantly hear fears about, well, will bystanders be shot or what have you, and yet out of all the cases that we talked about where permit holders have stopped these attacks, there's not a single instance where a permit holder has accidentally shot a bystander. You know, people often compare us to Europe. When we have these types of shootings, I often get calls from the media in other countries. But one thing is very clear, and that is Europe actually has about the same rate of multiple victim public shootings that we have here in the United States. It doesn't get the same attention when they occur. And also, I think because you have so many different countries, people don't kind of add them up. But you have to put it on a per capita rate. You just can't compare Norway or Germany to the United States. And when you add them up across all the countries and put it on a per capita rate, they're very similar rates between the United States and Europe. I mean, not only did you have the Norway attack last year in which 69 people were shot to death and another 110 were wounded as a result of the shooting, you know, ignoring the deaths from the bombing that he had. 2 years ago, you had 12 people killed in Britain by a taxi cab driver. You had attacks in Finland in both a mall and a university 2 years ago. France has had numerous attacks over the last few years. Germany, if you look at Germany, Germany has had 2 of the 4 worst public school shootings. And my guess is most Americans wouldn't have a clue about that, yet Germany has extremely restrictive gun control laws. It takes more than a year to go and get a long gun permit. You have to undergo 2 psychological screening tests. But, you know, the problem is that when somebody plans one of these attacks for many months in advance, it's very hard to stop them. And for somebody who wants to die in these attacks, if you combine somebody who wants to die, who's willing to die, and is willing to put the time into making these attacks go, it's very difficult to stop people in those situations. One of the comparisons that you often see made is people will say, well, look at murder rates in the United States and compare them to Britain or to Germany, and our murder rate is significantly higher. And they say, well, we have more guns, and so guns cause the higher murder rate. There's a really pretty obvious problem there, and that is murder rates and crime rates vary across countries for lots of reasons. The most powerful comparison, I think, is to see what happens to an individual country after its gun control laws change. So, for example, before London had any gun control, you had a city of about 8 million people. There were 2 gun murders in 1900. Murder rates have gone up after each of the major gun control regulations have been put in place in Britain. Same with Germany, same with other countries. When you see bans, you see these increases in murder rates. So if you accept the fact that there are many different reasons that murder rates differ across countries, for any individual country, just like it was true for Chicago and Washington, D.C., where we had bans there and saw huge increases in murder rates. You see the same thing across these other countries. So I don't know what else you want me to say, but, I mean, I could talk for a while. But.
That is great. You know, I wrote an article in 1999 after the Columbine, and I put it up on my site today. It's called The Schooling. And one of the ideas that I put forward in there is that why don't we take our, just say the public schools, and start giving them gun safety classes in within those public schools, and then get the teachers familiar with how to handle weapons, and let's get principals and some of the key personnel and arm them. What do you think about right. something like that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I don't see any reason. For states that had right to carry laws prior to 95 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed, it was possible to go and carry permanent concealed handguns on school property. People often seem to think whatever the rules are right now, they're the way they've always been, and that's simply not the case. And yet there were no problems, not one single problem that I've been able to identify or anybody else has identified with all those states that allow teachers and others to carry permanent concealed handguns on school property. In fact, one of the things I mentioned earlier, the first of the public school shootings in Pearl, Mississippi that was stopped by a permit holder, a guy named Joel Myrick, who's a former Marine, he used to carry a permanent concealed handgun with him when he taught there up until 95 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed. At that time, being a good law-abiding citizen, he stopped carrying it on school property, parked it in his car more than a quarter of a mile off school property. When the attack started in October 1997, he had to run literally a half mile to get his gun, a half mile back, and was still able to hold the attacker at point-blank range on the ground for 11 minutes before the police arrived. But, I mean, that's an example of a teacher who used to carry his permanent concealed handgun on school property. And if he'd still been able to do it as a result of the law, if the federal law hadn't changed there, he probably would have been able to stop the attack much sooner than he actually did.
Right. What I'd like to see, instead of gun-free zones, gun-protected zones in the school.
Right, well.
See?
Well, I mean, I have no problem with that. I think adults, whether it be university level or any school, any place, the problem is, when you create these gun-free zones, those are the places these criminals attack.
Right. Well, I tell you, I just wish we could get, well, we need this media to start waking up to some of the information in your fine book here.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you letting me talk about it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, John Lott, for being with us this evening. We certainly appreciate what you've done in this area. We certainly do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good night.
Coming up next is, I thought I'd end this second hour with a discussion that Mark Levine had on global warming. And this might give us a little bit of an alternative view than what the World Economic Forum is going to be talking about next week and pushing Greta Thunberg and so forth. But here we go with this great discussion about global warming. Here we go now.
Hello, America. I'm Mark Levin. This is Life, Liberty, and Levin. Welcome.
Nice to see you.
It's a great honor to see you, Patrick Michaels, doctor, expert on all things climate and environment, as far as I'm concerned. A little bit of your background. You're the director of the Center for Study of Science at the Cato Institute. You hold an A.B. and S.M. You hold those degrees in biology, sciences, and plant ecology from the University of Chicago. Pretty good school. PhD in ecological climatology from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, 1979. You're past president of the American Association of State Climatologists. You were program chairman for the Committee on Applied Climatology of the American Meteorological Society. Say that fast five times.
Yeah.
You were a research professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia for 30 years, and I'm giving an extensive, background that you have. I'm giving that to the public. So they know you really know what you're talking about. And you're a contributing author and a reviewer of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. All right, let's get started. climate change, global warming, global cooling. We've heard it all. What's going on out there?
Well, the surface temperature of the planet is warmer than it was 100 years ago, about 0.9 degrees Celsius.
0.9 degrees Celsius.
That's all.
Is that a lot?
No, it's not a lot. There are two periods of warming, one in the early 20th century that could not have been caused by human beings because we hadn't put enough CO2 in the air, and one in the later part of the 20th century that either slows down or ends, depending upon whose data you use, somewhere in the late 1990s, only to resume with the big El Nino that covered the news over the last couple of years. So that means that probably about half, maybe half, of that 0.9 degree might be caused by greenhouse gases. Because when the planet warmed beginning in 1976, the temperature of the stratosphere started to drop. And that's a prediction of greenhouse theory that's not intuitive. You know, the great philosopher of science, Karl Popper, said, if you can meet a difficult prediction with your theory, you can continue to entertain your theory. So the theory's right, but the application of it is wrong. It is nowhere near as warm as it's supposed to be. The computer models are making systematic, dramatic errors over the entire tropics, which is 40% of the Earth, and it's where all our moisture comes from, or almost all of it.
Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
Who does these computer models?
Governments. There are 32 families of computer models that are used by the United Nations, each government-sponsored, and all of them are predicting far, far too much warming. The disparity between what's been predicted to happen, which looks like this, and what is happening continues to grow.
We know that for a fact.
Yeah, because you can just look at the weather balloon temperatures, you can look at the satellite temperatures, you can look at something called the reanalysis data. They all behave in concert. So they're showing the same thing, and the same thing is a lot different than this thing. However, we need to call the special counsel.
Special counsel.
Yes, because one model works. And you know what it is? It's the Russian model.
So let me get this. So all the government models are like this.
Yeah.
The Russian model is like this.
Yeah. The Russian model has the least warming in it.
And the Russian model is the least warming, and the Russian model pretty much follows reality.
Yeah.
What's been tested over a few decades.
Yeah, correct. You know, if we were rational about this, think about the daily weather forecast. You know, you watch the Weather Channel, they go, oh, this model says that, that model says that. We think this one's working the best, so we're going to rely on that. Well, for climate forecast, we should be using the Russian model, but we're not. We use this big spate of all the other models that have this warming in them that's not occurring.
Why are all these other government models, 31 of them, I guess,
yeah,
wrong? And why do they all go in the same direction? Up.
Because they are what is called parameterized. They're all parameterized. Can I translate parameterized into English? Fudged.
Okay.
The don't get the right answer, don't know the right answer for certain phenomena. So we essentially put in code steps that give us what we think it should be. And the systematic error that was made was the models were tuned, as it said, tuned. Tuned to simulate the warming of the early 20th century. Began in 1910, ended in 1945, about 0.45 degrees Celsius. Mark, that could not have been caused by carbon dioxide.
Because there wasn't enough.
We hadn't put enough in. The background carbon dioxide concentration is 280 parts per million. When the first warming started, it was 298 parts per million. If the atmosphere is that sensitive to an 18 ppm change in CO2, we wouldn't be talking about this right now, and we'd be sweating bullets.
So what you're saying is man-made carbon dioxide earlier, the last century, could not have produced...
The early 20th century.
Early 20th century could not have produced this heat. So what did? Do we know?
No. And, you know, the three most important words in life may not be I love you. It might be I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows what kicked off that warming. There's lots of theories. One is that it was the final escape from a cold period, multi-century period, known as the Little Ice Age. That's a plausibility, but why did it happen then? But we just don't really have a good explanation for that. But because we forced the computer models to say, aha, human influence, CO2 and other stuff, we made the models too sensitive. And so that's why when you get to the late 20th century, all of a sudden they're warming up like crazy and the reality's down here. It was guaranteed to happen. This was revealed in Science Magazine in late 2016. And there was a paper that was published by a French climate modeler called The Art and Science of Climate Model Tuning. And in it, he speaks of parameterizing, we could say fudging, the models to give, his words, an anticipated acceptable range of results. So it's the scientist, not the science, that's determining how much it's going to warm. A lot of people don't know this, but it happens to be true. And, you know, we could speculate as to why that paper was published right before the 2016 election. I wouldn't want to impute causation, but gee, if...
But I want to ask you about causation.
Sure.
You have 31 governments.
No, the 31 different models. Some of
All right,
the
31 different models. Yeah. The multiple governments.
Right.
We're fudging the numbers.
They're not fudging them. They're
fudging the
models. They're parameterizing
them. Okay, well, you use the word fudging. Does our EPA do that? Does NASA do that?
Ah,
who does that for
us? Aha. Good question, Mark. Because the EPA was told by the Supreme Court in 2007 that if it found that carbon dioxide endangered human health and welfare, that it had the power to regulate it under the Clean Air Act.
This is the Massachusetts.
That's Mass EPA. Well, they produced an endangerment finding in 2009. And the endangerment finding for its prospective climate is 100%. I didn't say 90%. I said 100% based on those models. So if you can demonstrate that those models systematically are not working, you can take down the endangerment finding. And that would be the basis for all those policies that came out of the Obama administration.
Which would mean you don't get to regulate.
Absolutely.
Carbon dioxide.
Absolutely. The endangerment finding is the heart of the matter. And to give you an idea how gung-ho the Obama administration was on this issue, if you listen to his first inaugural speech, January 20th, 2009, it's the second substantive paragraph of the speech is about global warming after health care. 90 days after he finished that speech, his EPA produced a preliminary finding of endangerment from carbon dioxide. They were working on this before he was president. Bureaucrats can't work that fast. And then the final finding was made in December for the climate conference in Copenhagen that was supposed to produce another global warming.
So you're
agreement.
Telling us that we have a massive bit of public policy that has an enormous effect on society.
Absolutely.
That's built on, I'll use my word, phony models.
It's built on a house of cards. The models really don't work. And if I could really be arcane, I can explain the mechanism as to why they don't work.
As long as I understand it.
The models systematically predict that as you go up in the atmosphere in the tropics, which are 40% of the Earth, that the temperature should rise dramatically as you go further up in the atmosphere. So when you get to the level of the jet stream, the computer models are predicting 7 times, I didn't say 0.7 degrees, I said 7 times more warming than is being observed. Well, why is that important? Why am I boring you with that? Because it's the vertical distribution of temperature that determines upward motion, which means it determines precipitation. And guess what? Almost all the atmospheric moisture that we have around us today in humid Washington, D.C., that comes from the tropics. So if you get that vertical motion wrong down there, you get all the subsequent variables wrong. It's a fantastic systematic error. And again, that along with the difference between the surface temperatures, or rather the lower atmospheric temperatures and what's being observed, that's sufficient to kill the endangerment finding.
Okay, so to the average pedestrian like me, if you get that wrong, what does that mean? You get all the weather models wrong?
You get the subsequent weather wrong.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why, if you look at all these families of models, they predict radically different changes in precipitation from model to model. Well, probably because they got the precipitation initialization out of the tropics wrong. Precipitation's important. I offer you Wilmington, North Carolina, as an example. The precipitation is important coming from the tropics. Get that wrong, and you get that wrong.
Is weather getting worse?
No. I love that question, because what do you really want to look at? Roger Pilkey, Jr. at University of Colorado does this. Yes, there's more damage from weather because there's more stuff and people and property in the way of weather. So what you really want to look at are weather damages as a percent of GDP. And when you look at it that way, there's nothing whatsoever. Oh, I'm sure hurricanes are getting worse. I heard that on every legacy network during
Florence
and Harvey and all that stuff. Well, the fact of the matter is, there's a guy by the name of Ryan Maui, who's just a hotshot young tropical meteorologist. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and he tracks the energy in these tropical cyclones. Since we got global records that begin in 1970, and you would think there would be some relationship between that integrated energy and global warming. After all, it's only logical. Vice President Gore says that must be the case. It's not. There's no relationship whatsoever between the accumulated cyclone energy and the surface temperature of the Earth. It's just not there. Now, wait a minute. Why does our government say this? They said it in their last report called Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. They said, oh, there's been a significant increase in hurricane power in the Atlantic Ocean from like 1970 to 2009 or something like that, 1980 to 2009. Well, wait a minute. Why'd you stop in 2009? It's a 2014 report. Because if you take the data after 2009, the increase goes away and it goes back to where it was. Or why did you start in the mid-1970s? Because we have records that are really good back to 1920. And if you look 1920 to 1950, you see an increase that is exactly the same as the one that occurred.
So the information they're providing us
is skewed.
Incomplete. It's skewed.
It's skewed. They're cherry-picking.
Uh-huh. And here we rely on the climatologists, the
right.
meteorologists, and they become hyper-political. And I want to get back
Absolutely.
To that as soon as we return. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, you can watch Levin TV almost every weeknight by going to crtv.com/mark, crtv.com/mark, and sign up there, or give us a call at 844-LEVIN-TV, 844-LEVIN-TV.
We don't have time to include the rest of that this evening, but they're talking about politics. This climate action and this climate change and this global warming, those have all been created, their contrivances to control us politically. They started out in this country with Silent Spring and so forth. And there were real problems that we had with the environment. And we had this Love Canal, which destroyed that canal and created all kinds of sickness. And we still have some of those things. And those are the things that we should be taken care of, and I believe we have taken care of most of those. Now, what we don't have a discussion of, and what I don't see at Davos this year, 2020. This is the year 2020 at Davos. They're pushing this Greta Thunberg about, you know, global warming, climate action, and all this other stuff. But what I don't see happening right now is any discussion yet of the real problems like Fukushima with three melted down, you know, cores, coriums that are spewing forth all kinds of radioactive isotopes and material into the North Pacific and right off the coast there of Japan and ruining Japan and they're acting like they're, it's normal, that they're able to normalize Japan now. And the other thing that I don't see any talk at yet, and there may be, and some honest, you know, invitees, they don't invite them back once. They never invite them back if they tell too much of the truth about the world system. But anyway, the second thing is this quantitative easing, which is getting to be a big problem again. And I brought it up because at Davos, I noticed from 2008 and 9, where we had the big financial crisis, and it was a liquidity crisis. We have one developing now that's already here. There's all kind of quantitative easing in the tens of billions of dollars, the hundreds of billions of dollars already. And they have allocated $500 billion or $500 million set aside in their action to take care of this so-called ill liquidity crisis. But we'll have to wait and see at Davos if they'll talk about this. But I noticed over a successive number of years between, let's say, 2010 till last year about the debt crisis, which is really horrendous out there also. They were talking about it in real terms of it being a big problem, and slowly they forgot about it, and they don't emphasize it anymore. It's just like they can't do anything about it or something. And I'm thinking Fukushima is the same, but the American government and the Japanese government have put a lid on it, and they're trying to, you know, you could say gloss over it and make it into some kind of normality of some kind. But I don't think that's going to work too good. But anyway, the first thing, more guns, less crime. It's absolutely the truth. The liberal left, progressive left, wants to take all of our arms from us. And it's manifesting now up in Richmond come Monday. There's going to be a lot of people there. I just hope and pray that they'll come out of this safely. But anyway, they will be there protesting these new laws that the governor his legislature is trying to put on the books up there in Virginia, and these draconian types of laws, totally unconstitutional laws that he's trying to put on the books, but he is trying to do it. So, you know, we can't just, you know, ignore this. But then if we get trapped into some kind of a false flag operation up there and there's some shooting that starts, well, this thing could go haywire on everyone and could be a catastrophic problem for everybody. And I just don't want to see that. But anyway, we've got to hope and pray that Richmond doesn't turn out to be a problem that was an insurmountable problem. I want to thank you for listening with us tonight. Thank you. Good night.